Thank you. but especially in Kali Yuga, we can't do any of those things in such a powerful and exacting way. But therefore, our austerities should be centered around what is going to help us to be better servants, what is going to allow us to grow faster, what is going to allow us to give up attachments and sense gratification. And so then we do that which may be inconvenient, because normally we're so conditioned to doing that which is unhealthy. And so now to change, to do something that is healthy, seems like a task, or it seems like an imposition. And so we say austerity because we're really doing that which is natural and best for us, but it's just similar to an alcoholic or drug addict. So it's very austere, difficult for them to not take the drug because of what complications they experience. And they're genuine complications, but they put themselves in that situation because of an unhealthy and unnatural lifestyle. So our austerities are like what is going to allow us to have more of a natural lifestyle, which means giving nourishment to our original swarup, to our soul. So I'm going to address this topic, and I appreciate the austerity that you've made for coming out. I was thinking this morning, will I give the class or not? And I thought, some people will come, and they're undergoing the austerity. So why should I not undergo the austerity? That is the nature of healthy relationship, quality relationship. That's the nature of love. And so one is giving, another is giving, and at the same time there is a selfless competition. And sense gratification, posturing, there's also competition, but it's still again based on what I can get. But also in the school of the realm of love, there's also competition. The lovers are trying to see how to serve each other more, how to be more there for each other's needs, and how even to arrange things even before the lover even has to ask for it. It's one thing to get what is needed by your beloved, but even more, your beloved is so much attentive to you, and so much of you are part of your beloved's life, that you don't even have to ask. It is already arranged, and arranged even better than if you would have asked. So this is how the Lord loves us, that He arranges things even better than we could if we allow Him to. Our tendency is to try to arrange for ourselves and to think that we have to petition Him for something. That is a basic, fundamental, elementary type of relationship where you have to petition and there's business. But with love, it's not like that. It's spontaneous, it's organic, and it's joyful. So I was thinking also how powerful modern technology is, and at the same time how dangerous. I was thinking, and in spite of the difficulties, Krishna is so kind that every time I speak, I'm speaking to thousands of people. And I thought, so what is the austerity when we have such chance to be able to communicate, like our little discussion today here? So it goes on our tape ministry, our audio ministry, it goes on our video ministry, it goes on our cable TV program. It goes on the internet, like with the books. Each time a book comes out in English, then almost immediately it's printed in Russian, and then in Croatian, et cetera, so many other languages, about 10 other languages. This way, it's complex because something that is shared that is negative, like so much negative media is there, and it reaches millions and millions and billions of people sometimes. But something that's positive also has the ability to reach hundreds or millions or thousands or billions, even billions of people, if we are able to access the arrangements to amplify the message. We're also thinking how the devotees, just recently, the devotees in Alachua, it's the largest Hare Krishna community in the world of older Vaishnavas. I think about 500 devotees or 500 families. And so recently they had a program in reflection to myself, and honoring me, going over past times that I've had with many of them. And I was like so humbled that all of these senior devotees would spend a whole evening and just offer prayers and well wishes and speak to me through the camera and then send the video to me, wishing me well and thanking me for what contributions I have made or am making in the society. Of course, I in turn reciprocated. Again, love is based on such reciprocation and appreciation. And I just sent a message to the community how humbled I was, appreciative, but actually how important and valuable that they were of having one of the most significant communities for us in the world, maintaining their dedication after years and years, some of them 30, 34 years plus, engaged in service. And the kind of sacrifices and the austerity that they're engaged in is just awesome. And you put, you know, hundreds of people like that who've engaged in so much devotion and bhakti, and the bhakti is very rich because what is done is never lost in that sense. So I was thinking also how pioneers in any situation undergo some of the most austerity. And often they are not known or not appreciated. It's easy to appreciate something once it is in existence, it is vivid, it is vibrant, it is, you know, usable, you know, then people hear about it, know about it, and they enjoy it, or they use it. But it's not, usually things are not so known in their initial stages, because most things don't look so well in the beginning stages. And a lot of things start, you know, and they stop. And so many times people are not impressed until they can see that something has longevity. They're not impressed until they see the refinements, you know. It's like an artist, an architect, a mason or whatever. And you look at some of the initial work and you think, what is this? But then later, you see something beautiful, or if they have a plan or drawing of what it's going to look like at the end, and you think, okay, now you can make that jump. You can interpolate, you can visualize, you can speculate, okay, from here, this happens and this happens, this is what's going to be the final result. So the mind then looks at the whole picture of what will ultimately be, and you think, oh, you know, this is amazing. You look at the different parts initially, and it doesn't look, you know, so not so impressive. So many of these devotees have struggled in such ways, and they've laid these various initial aspects, and now there is this huge international society that's in all the major countries, and giving this very deep and esoteric knowledge of the nature of the soul. Some time back, I mentioned how in Ukraine, my last visit, last round the world tour, some of the devotees know I'm interested in you know, the monastic order, since I'm in the monastic order as a guru, as a sannyasi. And I find that whether it's Sufis or Muslims, no, not Muslims, because their marriage is there, Catholic priests or nuns, that often there's an interesting kind of richness, because when you deny yourself from one thing, then the tendency, if you do it genuinely, something else becomes stronger. It's like if you are blind, so you're not seeing, but many times then the sense of taste, the sense of hearing becomes stronger. And if you dedicate yourself more and more dependent upon the Lord, certain potencies come. So you'll find some of the richest expressions of devotion you often find amongst the monastic class, because as they go deeper and deeper into making sacrifices and engaging in austerities, committing themselves to the mercy of the Lord. So there was this one monastery that is quite world famous. I forgot the actual name they call themselves. But it's a group of monks who would bury themselves alive. Now, I don't mean, you know, under the grave, in your grave, but they would be entombed, but put into like a cave underground. And they would have bars then sealed off, and so there was no anybody going in or going out. And the idea is that literally they would stay there and just eat very simply and just pray and chant unto death. So the idea was that they were just so determined that they wanted to meet God in this lifetime. And because of that, they cut off all basic activities of interacting, of pursuing any kind of sensual pleasures, and engaged in such an intense austerity that they just committed themselves to just crying out for the Lord every day, every hour, understanding that the Lord will, you know, will reciprocate as they give what? As they give literally death to the physical body and life and nourishment, you know, to the soul. So what they were really doing is just slowly dying. And that, you know, you can't just be in a dark place and live for a very long time without sufficient air, without medicine, without care, because you get sick, you know, after a while. And you can't just be in a place without talking, you know, they weren't talking to anyone either. So you don't go to the place where you don't tell. Now, in other words, if you do like that, you either go crazy or you die very fast. So now the question is, do you die crazy or do you die, you know, with the devotion and dedication? The other day we were talking about Divya Mata, divine madness. So there's mad. Either way, you're going to go mad. So you're just going to go mad, talking to yourself and cursing everybody and begging to get out. And see, once you were sealed, there was no question of anyone leaving. It was understood that if you're going here, it means this is it. And when you yelled and cry and scream, everyone understood that this was part of the process of you unfolding. This was part of the austerity. And according to your, what we say, adhikar, quality, will determine if this is going to make you, you know, divine being, or what is going to prepare you perhaps for the next life where you have to try again. So I wanted to see this place. I was just amazed because, you know, I had read something about these priests, the Jesus prayer, I think came from them also. And there's a famous order, just somehow I can't think of the name. The monastery was beautiful, you know, very, very, it's like going on a sacred pilgrimage tour, different holy places. People come from all over the world because just by seeing these tombs and some of the priests, the bodies in some cases were still there. After they died, then they would just put the bodies in a glass case. And practically all of them who did this, the bodies, you know, never fully deteriorated, didn't smell or anything. And so people have been known to come and to get and to pray and to be healed from all kinds of issues and diseases and madness and all types of things. So it shows how intense the austerity was, how much they were determined to know the Lord in this lifetime. And it kind of, I mean, it's an extreme case, but it reminds us of what we find in Srimad Bhagavatam. Brahma says, an easy life and devotional service go ill together. Now, that doesn't mean that we should, become masochists or sadists, that we are people who love pain, and so we give ourselves pain and consider this is something that's pious or that's spiritual. No. Again, it means that we are ready to do what is necessary, even though maybe inconvenient, for higher cause. Now, the extreme case is like the case of Raghunath Das and others who didn't eat anything, like the Goswamis, yeah, but we look and see what. They basically didn't sleep, you know, they often didn't eat. But really, it wasn't so much that they were thinking, I'm not going to eat today, I'm not going to sleep. But they were focused on so much engaging in their activities that it didn't bother them and they had no time for it. Like with my health problem now, I really haven't had good sleep or really haven't slept in about 6 or 7 weeks. And so even yesterday I was thinking, you know, I'll sleep an hour, wake up, sleep half an hour, wake up, 2 hours sometimes. It goes on like that. There's a sequence my body has gotten into due to the sickness. But I was thinking last night, how hellish this is. And I was getting to understand what people go through when they have insomnia. And there are millions of people who have that problem. But then I was realizing, but at least in my case, I may not be sleeping, but Krishna has arranged that I can just rest. And a certain amount of rest adds up to a certain amount of sleep gradually. It's not quite the same, you know. But quality sleep, just like we know, the more powerful hours are from like 10 to 12. So if you can somehow get in bed before that time, then you may have to take 4 hours, additional hours, to get the quality of sleep, you know, those 2 hours. So usually when I lay down, the first hour and a half or 2 hours, I sleep. And after that, then I'm up and I'm up and I'm up. But I was thinking, well, at least I got, you know, 2 good hours in. But that's different. That wasn't a planned austerity. It wasn't because of I was so much involved in praying and chanting and writing that I just didn't have time to sleep. But with the Goswamis, they literally did not sleep sometimes because of their involvement of just being so absorbed, and therefore they were living off spiritual energy. So we don't want to shun or be intimidated by austerity. We don't want to engage in austerity in the mode of ignorance. That's where someone does things that really doesn't bring about a higher spiritual understanding or spiritual result, that's destructive to them and gives destruction to the environment. At the same time, we do want to remind ourselves that an easy life is not what we're looking for. We should expect challenges, difficulties. Now, we shouldn't think that we are going to have to undergo the austerities of the very great acharyas or prophets, sons and daughters of God. You notice their lives were more, they encumbered more difficulties than we can ever imagine. But their lives were also an example to remind us that this is part of the course of for purification and acceleration out of the material world. That if we are having too easy of a life, then it's a sign that we're too much integrated into the norms of society, which means that we're too much accepting the environment of the prison, and we're comfortable in the prison. When you're in a situation and you're making the best of it, but you're constantly trying to see how to rise above it or how to escape. So we're in a situation where the body is in prison, and the soul is in prison, dehi, in this dehi, in this physical body, and that is an unnatural situation, and we are constantly to be in a mindset, a mind culture, where we are arranging and preparing to leave. So the little meditation I have today, it focuses on that. We're talking about the austerities that are natural. The Brahma says that easy life and devotional service does not go well together. We see the lives of people who start things, pioneers, how they go undergo tremendous austerity to get something going, but that foundation allows so much to be built upon. And without that foundation, it's show bottle, it's phantasmagoria, and things will not, you know, prevail, not be a sense of longevity. That this case, like in Ukraine, an example of intense focus and dedication, where one was thinking in the mood of, I must meet the Lord in this lifetime. And whatever cost that is necessary, then I'm ready to do it. I mean, my little, you know, small posture of bringing on some of this disease myself by asking to be able to experience something that will allow me to free many others from some of their struggles. A little form of austerity, of recognizing that austerity ultimately brings great opulence and wealth of spirituality, realization, and it brings out more love, because that is nature of the soul. The soul itself is just satyajnanavika. It's full of knowledge. It's eternal and it's full of love. And so, we don't say like that, but really, when you're dealing in austerities that are proper, you're actually saying death to the physical and birth and life and full rejuvenation to my real identity, to the soul. So this is an extreme case. They're saying like quick death by putting themselves in these tombs and not going on. And one would have to see it, you know, to believe it. They would just bring them a little, you know, just a little sustenance, you know, bread, some soup, you know, maybe once a day or something. There was no toilet, so I guess they had a little bucket and they would put that out, I guess, as they're passing. No talking, no visitors, and they would just pray and chant and cry. You know, they have rosary until they die. And then once someone would die, then they would the person's body, in most cases, would be very unusual because of the level of consciousness. It wouldn't smell and didn't, you know, deteriorate as bodies normally would. And they would put them in a case or in a special area. So people would come, you know, and they would visit. The last thing is, and I'll read this, that I mentioned about in Russia, how I went to one or two famous palaces. And I see why, in some ways, why they had the, you know, the revolutions there. Because the royalty, just like in many places in antiquity, the royalty really splurged their wealth. And so you had some palaces that were a whole block. I mean, it's like a city, you know. I mean, we have malls now, right, where you can go into the mall and you just get everything you want. You know, everything is jumping out at you. You don't have to go to no other place because there's all these stores and all these facilities. So some of the older palaces, they were like that. That people were going to them, and there was just all kinds of facilities based on things that were available, you know, at that time. So it's like you're walking, you know, like in a mall, one or two of the palaces I went to. And then there was a very famous bridge. And then one of the devotees, after we left, mentioned, Maharaj, you wouldn't believe the thousands, maybe he said 10,000, but the thousands of people who died in building that palace, and the thousands of people who died in building the bridge. So many people were sacrificed in building this wonderful structure Now we could be admired, but sometimes the history of how such was built, you know, is no longer so much present in people's consciousness. And so, again, the power of austerity, but without such things, would have never happened. You take any major bridge or something or construction, you find that some people may have gotten hurt, wounded, or died, you know, in the process. And that is considered that that can happen. So what I want to read today is called The Comfortable Prisoner Does Not Have a Passion for Elevation. The comfortable prisoner does not have a passion for elevation. Just focusing on the fact that being comfortable and pursuing comfort and ease, looking for shortcuts, denying the significance of undergoing some inconvenience for a higher cause, will not allow one liberation, will not allow the person to accelerate sufficiently in their spiritual life. The Swarup Lakshana. Swarup Lakshana means the central aspect of devotional service, central quality, central aspect, most important, is to have full dependence on Krishna and to never forget him. See, the most important thing, never forget the Lord. They do things that are favorable, avoid things that are unfavorable. Rupa Goswami, the great renunciate from Vrindavan, also explains the importance of full dependence on Krishna as the foremost tenet in advancing in Krishna consciousness. We look at all of the basic things that's necessary for advancing our spiritual life. And one of the foremost is full dependence. We accept that the Lord is our well-wisher and our best friend. Should not just be tuned into ordinary considerations. So important is that we are dependent. As I'm undergoing this very interesting adventure, drama, that in some cases for some seems like a nightmare, but of many things is coming out of it, and sometimes God brothers and God sisters will call me from all over the world, and one of the things that comes up is, what are some of your realizations? Because they realize that undergoing such experiences, you're going to have a certain kind of realizations that comes from that. That's just the nature of the transcendental process, if we're aligned properly. And one of the things I always share is the degree of dependence, of how much Krishna has put me in a situation where I have to be more dependent on him. And even though physically that's frustrating, because it means that one is out of control. Physically it means that one is not certain or dealing with ambiguity, but spiritually it means then one has to make themselves more available for whatever Krishna is arranging, whatever the Lord is doing, with a chance to surrender, to be able to accept what the Lord's plan is. Rupa Goswami explains, this is the foremost, Swarup Lakshana, the foremost tenet of bhakti, to be dependent. Now if you analyze that again, we talk about love, you love someone, they're dependent upon you, that much more you can give. You love someone, they're dependent upon you, that much more they can connect with what you are arranging for them. If they're not dependent and making themselves available, even though your love is there, even though you've arranged, they're going to miss cue, they're going to miss them sometimes, because they're not going to make themselves receptive, or they're not going to be available, or they're not even going to understand how much you are there for them. And so they won't take advantage of it. Now, if you are loving them, and they're dependent on you, and you are happy because you can be able to offer value, then every time you do, you're more excited about the next thing that you can arrange. And that is the phenomenal arrangements and exchanges that go on in the spiritual world, not only with the divine couple, but with everyone, and how they are serving each other selflessly. When we do not sufficiently depend on Krishna, we think of ourselves as the controllers, and we interfere with Krishna's mercy. Okay, keeping that in mind, when we do not sufficiently depend, we think that things are more under our own control, and then we cheat ourselves because we interfere with what's available. We interfere with Krishna's mercy, his blessings, his empowerment, and his love descending upon us. The material world and the material body. They are designed to create an arena where the living entities can try to think of themselves as separate from Krishna, from God, without recognizing His supreme control over all things. So one way of looking at material life or conditioned life is that entities are denying the Lord's mercy by thinking that it's not so wonderful, not available, and therefore they're thinking more about what they can do with their own little limited power, and based on that, they miss chance to connect with the source of divine power, divine Shakti. Such thinking means they will continue undergoing repeated birth and death, captivated by illusions of material culture. Conversely, as living entities give up the artificial tendency to be the supreme controllers, they become properly situated in transcendence. So it's almost like the opposite of mature culture. One wants to be dominant, control, manipulate, have leverage over others. And in spiritual life, one is trying to be more and more at the mercy of the Lord, of Sadhu and Guru. A great danger lies in remaining too comfortable and in experiencing only ordinary encounters in our life. See, once we are at stages in our spiritual life where things become too easy or things become comfortable, then it means we've become too mechanical. Like Haridas Thakur is expressing that he hasn't finished his rounds, or expressing chanting. Although he was a Nama Acharya, we see that he didn't even have to chant, but he was showing us how we should always be in the mood of becoming. The Goswamis, they were always, where's Radha, where's Krishna? Even though they have fully captured them. So the mood is never to get comfortable, even when one has become totally pure, because the mood is always understanding that there is higher, there's more to experience. And there's also the mood of whatever one is receiving, one is feeling unqualified for what mercy is coming. When you are too comfortable, it means that you feel that what has come to you, you deserve. And when you are feeling that what has come to you is more than what you're worthy of, or has some special benefit, then what happens? You're uncomfortable because you want to either come up to the point of being worthy, or you feel so humbled by what has come that you feel almost embarrassed. Somebody gives you something really wonderful, and you're uncomfortable because you feel, I don't deserve this. But at the same time, you're excited. When we live a typical and ordinary life, we're more likely to accept the illusions of the material body, and we are more likely to be satisfied as prisoners in the material world who are away from their true home, the kingdom of God. The comfortable prisoner does not have the pressure to achieve liberation. In the material world, people are very desperate to become rich with many opulences. We say that Krishna's two Bhagavan son, Krishna has all the opulences. And so people in the material world basically are trying to be God. Aishwarya, Krishna has the opulences of wealth. Or we say virya, in Sanskrit, Krishna has the opulence of strength. Or we say renunciation, vairagya. Or knowledge, jnana. So all of these was beauty, Sri, that wealth and knowledge and strength and renunciation, Sanskrit vairagya, that these are qualities, if you think about material life. Somebody's trying to be the most beautiful, beauty pageants, people are trying to dress and do things such a way, and plastic surgery, all these things, trying to be the most beautiful. Somebody's trying to be the most intelligent, somebody's trying to be the most wealthy. That basically material life means individuals constantly competing, really trying to grab the opulences that really are fully possessed by the Lord. So the rest of the discussion talks about these things. In the material world, people are very desperate to become rich with many opulences, Aishwarya. They want to acquire as many commodities, assets, and money as possible, because having such makes them feel powerful. With their money, they can influence and control all kinds of people and situations. Nothing's wrong with money, but people usually want it for improper reasons. The power associated with wealth can be very intoxicating and can cause a person to have an unhealthy dominance over others. This is why so often people, it can vary. But some very pious people are wealthy, and they use that Shakti, that power, to do all kinds of things. You can't make anything happen without Shakti. But the tendency is that when you have wealth, fame, etc., the tendency for most people is that it causes them to be more dependent on themselves. And it takes away from their ability to be dependent on the Lord. Consequently, they can fall into a dangerous position of finding satisfaction as a prisoner in the material world, away from their true home, the kingdom of God. After all, the comfortable prisoner does not have the passion for liberation. In the material world, people very desperately try to make themselves beautiful, free. They go out of their way to buy lovely and expensive clothes. They pay regularly for fancy hairdos. I was reading something the other day that there's one type of hairdo that some of the girls get that costs over $1,000. Huh? You know that one, right? the kind of braid, the type. I was shocked. I saw it in either Time or Newsweek a couple of weeks ago. The old issue, and they were talking about hairdos and the price: $500, $700, $1,000, $1,200. And it takes like half the day to be able to get the hair fixed like that. Those who are considerate, most beautiful, participate in beauty pageants or act as models, which can be very intoxicating for those involved. And anybody who knows what that world is like, you know that it's very complex and full of sense gratification, full of illicit sex, drugs. Others will admire, lust after, and seek them out, relating to them based on their attractive and captivating body features. It reinforces the illusion that there is some great perfection in having a temporary attractive body. We say temporary because how attractive one's body is, it's going to change. Just a matter of years, the body starts changing. It reinforces the illusion that there is some great perfection in having a temporary attractive body. It is surely temporary because no matter how attractive people may be, in time their bodies will be deteriorating, and the same people who are so captivated by their own image will find their bodies to become repulsive. Having highly attractive features and investing excessive time in increasing that attractiveness can be very dangerous, for it can cause people to find satisfaction in remaining a prisoner in the material world, away from our true home, the kingdom of God. After all, the comfortable prisoner does not have the passion for liberation. Now, kids, even younger than teenagers, are going in for plastic surgery. In the material world, people are very eager to become most famous. This is in Sanskrit, yashaha. They are starving for attention and will often go through any means to become the center of attention. We normally do not realize how much we deny, sabotage, exploit, and manipulate others for our own selfish reasons. One can justify all kinds of deviations when the ego is totally intoxicated by distinction and adoration. When one has achieved great fame, it can be even worse because such a person is more likely to be condescending toward others. Often when a person becomes popular or famous, then they're seeing themselves high, others are encouraging them in that way. So because there's adoration, distinction, and the tendency is then to look down on others. And such person will also have trouble honoring feedback as well. Fame can be very dangerous, for it can cause people to find more satisfaction in remaining a prisoner in the material world, away from our true home, the kingdom of God. After all, the comfortable prisoner does not have the passion for liberation. One of the senior devotees called me the other day. This is right now they're having the North American GBC meeting. And actually two or three people called and asked if there was any advice or reflections that I had that they should think about or maybe share with our leaders from America and Canada, presidents and GBC. And one of the things I mentioned is how important it is for leadership to honor and to celebrate the culture of feedback, critical feedback. Because the tendency is that when you're in a powerful position, it's easy to function based on hearing what people say that is comfortable for you, or it's easy to accept things that you are already accepting, and you get reinforced. That doesn't bring about sufficient growth. And when leaders are together, it doesn't matter whether it's in the political, educational, commercial, religious situation, the tendency is that leaders are in that position because they have something a little more outstanding, or they've excelled in some way. So therefore, so much can happen when people can take advantage of accepting feedback from others to find out more about what their presence means, what their offerings are, find out how they're doing. And so often people interact in such ways without really honoring and looking for critical feedback. That when it comes, they may take it in the sense of someone has said something critical, therefore they mark the person as enemy. Or someone has said something critical and they shut down, even though they may not act in such a way externally, but they shut down because that person didn't say something that fits into a comfortable space for them. And then someone says something that reinforces their own idea, and they bring that person in. And so that is, unfortunately, it's not real servant leadership, and it causes a big issue. So I wanted to share that, because it's a serious problem that most communities have, and we surely have that also as leaders. So when there is power, yashaha, the tendency is often to sit on the power, or the tendency is not to be so accommodating and receptive when others around you do not do or say something that adds to your own prestige, power, adds to your own image of yourself or your own plan. And we can be better persons if we really are there for others. We hear from them, how am I doing? We hear from them what I'm trying to do or arranging, just how is it impacting upon you? You know, it's easy just to mark people off. And that tendency is there, and that's neophyte. But the deeper level of devotion is one is often even more attentive to those who have an issue, because people who have an issue with you can often share something that others want, or they can help you look closer at what you need to do to help them to understand better what you're doing. In the material world, people not only want to be known as being very strong, this is virya in Sanskrit, but they want to be an association of others who have great power and great strength. They might want strength themselves, they want to be known to be around or know people who are powerful, because things happen. And the power opens doors, gives results. So they can steal power from them. But often one wants to be around somebody who's powerful because they're envious. Or they're trying to get something from them, they have ulterior motives. Or they're trying to find out, how does she do what she do? What's behind his success? Let me get close and find out so I can capture that and have that myself and even have it better. Those who are strong are feared and they have their way. Since others do not challenge them as much, they bully or intimidate others more. Their strength often causes them not to sufficiently appreciate another person's contribution. Often the strong naturally minimize or condescending toward the weak. Their own strength makes them minimize being a team player. When people have a reputation for strength, although they're actually weak, they try to cover up their weaknesses and consequently do not open themselves up to receive help. And that is the issue. We're having strength, or others see us in a position of strength. The tendency is that we don't feel a need to open up, or our image is of such that we feel we can't afford for people to see a weakness. And so even when we are weak, and even when there's a chance for improving, we are shut down because of ego. They think that no one else is in a proper position to help. Strength can be dangerous, for it can cause people to find more satisfaction in remaining a prisoner in the material world, away from our true home, the kingdom of God. After all, the comfortable prisoner does not have the passion for liberation. In the material world, people are eager to show how much knowledge, gyan, in Sanskrit, we study knowledge as gyan, one person tries to show their knowledge by defeating another, through debate or by collecting such excessive amounts of information. Remind you, it's not, we're in an information age, not a wisdom age or knowledge age. There's a so much information and data processing. There is so much information available, but a shortage of knowledge and wisdom. Pseudo-knowledge as information makes one proud. Therefore, it can be very dangerous, for it can cause people to find more satisfaction in remaining a prisoner in this material world, away again from our true home, the kingdom of God. After all, the comfortable prisoner does not have a passion for liberation. Two or three more paragraphs. In the material world, people are often eager to prove or show they are full of renunciation. Renunciation, Vairagya. Such people proudly want to show how they have so much self-control and how they are detached. So this can be another form of God playing. One is excessive involvement in sense gratification. Another is to try to show how super, you know, renounced you are, how much you are powerful by avoiding things and denying things. Mainly they are eager for it to be known that while others are so disturbed, they are special in as much as they are much more wealthy, beautiful, famous, and stronger than others. They feel themselves to be naturally superior and therefore detached and most renounced. This so-called great renunciation is itself an expression of great hunger, a great false ego, and again, a tendency to see oneself as controller. Therefore, it can be very dangerous, for it causes people to find more satisfaction in remaining a prisoner in the material world, away from our true home, the kingdom of God. After all, the comfortable prisoner does not have a passion for liberation. So what are we talking about today? So the opulences of wealth, Aishwarya, beauty, Sri, fame, yasha, strength, virya, knowledge, gyan, renunciation, vairagya, are actually the qualities that Krishna possesses in full. Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is equipped fully with all of these opulences. So God is having all of these that people individually are trying to have or trying to collectively have as many as possible. It really is what identifies the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has this in full. So being a prisoner means we're still stealing, trying to have what ultimately belongs to the Lord, which also we have our original sarup, is that we are part and parcel of Krishna. You know, we're suffering. Mami vam so jiva loke jiva puta shanatana vanashitani jani pagati kani karsati. We are part and parcel then in the suffering condition, same in quality as the Lord, different in quantity. But we're not recognizing that, and we're cheating ourselves by trying to grab this against the spiritual process of Sadhu, Shastra, and Guru. Krishna is equipped fully with all the opulences. It is natural that these opulences are sought after as they are most attractive. But since the Supreme is most attractive, no one has opulences greater than Him. The nature of the conditioned soul is that he wants to act as the Lord. He is full of the energy of God, and therefore he wants to be the most attractive. When the living entity is in possession of any of these opulences or focus on trying to acquire them, even if he becomes a high achiever in any or all of these areas, it can be most dangerous because the jiva can increase his false ego and most unfortunately increase his illusion of being the controller. And then I end with this reflection. As stated, the Swarup Lakshana said the major tenet of devotional service is full dependence on Krishna. To depend fully on Krishna and always think of Him is the essence of Bhakti Yoga, the science of giving up false proprietorship. All things which reinforce our false identification with the material body and the material world incarcerate us more in the material prison by thinking of ourselves as controllers. We keep interfering with Krishna's mercy, His blessing, His empowerment, and love descending upon us. When we are confronted with chronic illness and other great challenges, we are not pursuing an ordinary life, and we are not overly intoxicated in trying to possess the opulences of Krishna, we are great candidates for becoming first-class bhaktas. It is the mercy of Guru and Krishna who reminds us from time to time that we are not the controllers. See, sometimes abrupt things happening, calamities happen, difficulties coming in our lives are a major way how Krishna gives a blessing in disguise by reminding us very distinctly and emphatically and categorically and unequivocally that we are not in control. And this can help us how? To not to be relaxed as prisoners in the material world. It is the mercy of Guru and Krishna who remind us from time to time that we're not the controllers. Thus we can depend more on their guidance, their empowerment, and mercy while appreciating Krishna's all-attractive opulences. I am the beggar who is full of gratitude that Guru and Krishna have forced me to better see that I am not the controller, so as to be a less comfortable prisoner in the material world. Therefore, my position for returning back to the spiritual world has increased profoundly. So, what we discussed today, in quick summary, is the fact that austerity is very significant. That there cannot be any major advancement without austerity. Lord Brahma says an easy life and devotional service goes ill together. That this is not campaigning austerity in the mode of ignorance of people suffering and wanting to suffer and making others suffer, but it's a emphasis that when you are dedicated, you do not just do what comes easy. When you're in love, you do not just do what is comfortable for you, but the opposite. You are selfless and thinking more about your beloved. I gave the story of the monks in Ukraine and how this is an extreme case, or like Raghunath Das Bhakta, Raghunath Das Goswami, who basically, you know, didn't eat anything, or Dhruva Maharaj, we see amazing austerity, whereas special agents went to extreme cases of dedication. These are extreme, but the theme is there. Like in that, I'm showing even in other traditions you find something that's quite similar, as all of our programs reach an audience, a vast heterogeneous audience. So, this case in Ukraine of how these monks allowed themselves joyfully to be imprisoned in a tomb, literally to be buried alive. And so I said how when I was there last on the world tour, I had this wonderful chance to visit some of these tombs. But one would agree to be put in and sealed off, and it's just a little window with bars, and so they stay there to death. And a little a soup and bread or something once a day. And the idea was just to pray and to chant, to give death to the physical body and for contact with the Godhead. Then I mentioned how, like in Russia, visiting several palaces and seeing a wonderful construction of a bridge and being reminded that people died in the process of constructing this. And then reflecting on how in our own institution and in other institutions and in special projects, how yes, the beauty is there, but some initial serious austerity has taken place as a basic foundation that has allowed something, you know, to grow and to be appreciated. And then I related to my own case, that my present situation has also been a part of putting myself in with prayer to be able to undergo certain austerities for purification, as well as for self, as well as for facilitating, you know, the society, facilitating others. And then I mentioned about the Alachua and how so many devotees are there who went out of their way in so many years in maintaining service. And then we read the beggar prayer, where we basically looked at the opulences of Krishna and seeing how entities in the material prison, material body, material culture are literally stealing, trying to claim what ultimately belongs to Krishna in full. And therefore they remain year after year, lifetime after lifetime, in the material world. And how when one is ready to transcend or leave the material world, they must recognize and accept that these ultimately belong to the Lord. And last, they must appreciate the potency of dependence. So we end what we start with, this Swarup Lakshana, is that the major tenet of devotion is to be dependent on the Lord. And so Krishna does many things, give mercy in disguise, but wherever it can help us to be more dependent. And sometimes we have to have abrupt things happen in our lives. We have to be shaken out of something, embarrassed out of something, at the beginning, some initial difficulty or attack that allows us to see that we're not fully in control. The more things are going according to our plan, we're comfortable, then the tendency is to think that we're in control and to feel comfortable. So we don't want to ask for suffering or misery, but we do want to ask and pray for acceleration and purification. And then we must be also ready to accept whatever inconvenience or test or challenge comes with that purification. It's similar to taking a medication that may be a little bitter. So you are asking the pharmacist or the holistic practitioner, explaining your issue and your problem, and now you get some medication, a prescription. Now, along with that prescription, there is perhaps some complexities, or there's some austerity. You take it before meal or after meal, or you do like this, like that. And so because of that, you are sensitive to knowing, I take this and in the right way, and I get this kind of result. So austerity is engaged in mode of goodness and transcendence will bring tremendous acceleration, because it's really saying death to the physical body, life and birth to the soul. It's saying no more do we want to remain a prisoner in the material world, accepting the normative patterns of the prison environment. And it means that we begin to already to live like those who are liberated on the spiritual kingdom. And as we begin to live like that, then there's no reason for such entity to have to stay in confinement. Somebody's no longer acting as a criminal. There's no reason why they have to continue to stay as a criminal. They've done their time. They have compunction or regret. They've transformed. And so now they are reviewed for the parole board, and they are able to go. Someone's in the hospital. Someone's sick, etc. And so they no longer show signs of the sickness. There's no reason to keep them in that situation. So once we no longer are showing the madness of sense gratification, we're no longer showing the madness of identifying with the body as the all in all, then the Lord in the heart first, Savasham Sani Vesto Matak Smithi Gyan or Paul Namcha, Lord in the heart, and so many of his representatives, they see us. They are very perceptively they're very perceptive where there's authentic bhakti. And so where there's authentic bhakti, they are those agents who come to rescue, to reinforce, to protect, and to reclaim souls who have been sentenced to these prisons. So let us all do our own parts in trying not to be comfortable in the material world, because life is an adventurous affair. And from a healthy struggle, there comes the realization and the strength and the love. And from healthy struggle for one's beloved, one is able to experience a greater sense greater sense of humanity, greater sense of spirituality. We are as powerful as we're able to touch the lives of others. It's like I am in a terribly weak state, physically. I mean, even doing little things, you wouldn't know it the way I speak right now, because when I'm doing something spiritual, I get strength. I'm in a terribly weak state. But actually, I'm in the strongest state that I've ever been in this lifetime on this planet. Because right now, my physical weakness and sickness and my challenges where I may die next week, next month, or a few months, or maybe a few years, has put me in a situation where I can be more of a servant to others than ever before. So what may in one sense seem to be a problem with lack of physical mobility and ability to do the normal things that I would do, and in many unusual ways, is a blessing in disguise, because it gives me more chance to impact upon the lives of others. So by that, it means my own quality of life has accelerated, because life has so much to do with to the degree that you're able to impact upon the life of another person. And for a spiritualist, the degree that you're able to help another being is to the degree that your own essence is significant. It's like where there is devotion, where there's bhakti, then bhakti is contagious. And so the more that one gets caught by the bhakti lata bij creeper, and the more it's nourished, then the more also one can then infect others in various ways. So again, the Lord arranges dependency so that he can do what he's always ready to do. someone becomes more pure or someone becomes totally pure, what it really means is that there's less interference with Krishna's guidance, Krishna's blessings. There's less interference with Krishna's presence. So that purity means that such entities are less and less trying to be the controller, trying to do what they think should be done, and interferes with what can be done in a higher way. This is the idea about being a Shakti Vesh or the Shakti Vesh avatar, or being a puppet, or this Swarup Lakshana full dependency. What it's really saying is, let Krishna drive. Let Krishna come through. Let him arrange what is best for all by having faith and understanding that he can do it, and then having the dependency of letting it happen. So in one sense, this whole discussion was to present that point of Swarup Lakshana, of dependence, and how these opulences that really belongs to Krishna is trying to be, we say, yes, blessed on the yesterday hijacked in a negative way. The living entities in the mature world are trying to claim proprietorship of what really belongs to the Lord, and as we direct things in that particular paradigm of putting Krishna in the center, then we move genuinely to the center because we're part and parcel of Krishna, and Krishna wants to glorify his devotees more than they want to glorify him. And that's the ironic thing, is that literally the more we make genuine sacrifices of austerity, the more that there is wealth. It's like the wealth of the brahmana is the knowledge. The wealth of the devotee is actually the wages that we get from devotion is more chance to serve. And the service is sometimes physical, sometimes not. So it's like Krishna is giving me, Prabhupada is giving me more wages by putting me in a situation where I am literally less active but more able to impact upon people's hearts. So we want to pray, how can we be more dependent? We want to be more aware of moving ourselves away from trying to claim the opulences. Most of all, we want to be careful not to try to organize our lives, but we're trying to look for comfort based on our physical needs. Physical needs are real, but we want to look closer at our spiritual needs. We organize our lives based on what is going to be best for our spiritual needs. As we do that, that will automatically bring about healthy austerity. So maybe there's a few questions or comments. Reinforces that. Like when Krishna says, one who is dear to him is unaffected by happiness or distress. stress means that these things are also in the environment and imposed upon such person, but the more advanced individual understands that this is all part of the atmosphere. It doesn't get overly, you know, disturbed by it. It's like, you know, the young girl's pregnant, and she's not so much sensitive to, except, you know, she's a teenager, 12, 13 years old, not sensitive to what a woman undergoes when she's pregnant, and it's really bewildering to her. But now she's had two or three babies, and she knows from the first and second time, you know, what to encounter. So she's having maybe similar, even more complications, but her understanding of how she's processing it is actually different. What we want to do is to be able to process it a little better. There's nothing wrong with the challenges of Shraddha or faith sometimes. As long as we're in the material body, we're going to have some challenges of faith. Once we are fully connected with the spiritual realm, then of course that's not an issue. But as long as we're in the material body and there's some, you know, duality that's coming and going, part of our conditioning, there'll be some issues of faith. When they come up, we just have to more and more see it is that it's just the mind. The mind is engaged in sankalpa, vikalpa, it's accepting and rejecting something. But it's doing that because of what the atmosphere is. And then in the end, we have to realize our leaders, doesn't matter, superiors, mentors, sometimes will disappoint us. Our husbands, our wives, our children, our co-workers, they'll disappoint us. What are we associating with? Sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. Sometimes they'll cheat us. But Krishna, but God will never cheat us. Even when we don't have faith in other things, we have to have more faith in the Lord. And realize behind it all, that as long as you're having deeper faith in God, then it's on Him to arrange to accommodate that faith. Other questions?
You spoke about this a little bit.
Can you grab the mic?
You touched upon this a little bit in your talk, but I was hoping you could elaborate on it. You mentioned a few situations where people were thrust into the dependence on the world and their own situation. Pioneers of our movement also would be, you know, pulled out of their comfort zones and brought into the high positions of memory. Most of us were kind of, we have a very predictable life day to day, and it's also in some ways just kind of where our institutions at. Like, not having an establishment per se, pretty simple social phenomenon. So, how do we, doing the service that needs to be done, if taking Alfred Kuhn to the next step, how do we also imbibe this deep movement of dependence courageously and selectively and still kind of take the gradual steps that it would be?
See, that's where culture is important and family is important. Family is really culture, or culture is really a microcosm of family. Family is a microcosm. In culture, you have different generations. You have differences in the family. But in a strong culture, like in a strong family, those differences can bring about beauty because it brings out variegatedness that can be used to complement, to protect, and to empower and inspire. So take a so-called ideal family model. You have grandparents and you have elders. So the elders and grandparents are distributing their wisdom. They have left a legacy, or they're leaving a legacy. And so you learn something from that. You cherish that. You have something from mother and father that you get very special, you know, from them. You get something from peers. So first is to capture that legacy, term worn to it. So what the acharyas have made available for us, what our founder acharya, more immediate grandparent, has given, what he's done. There's so many books and tapes and things out now about how he lived. Even before, you know, he started his mission, I'm reading a book now, Mula Prakriti, who just passed recently from cancer, written this awesome book of interviewing so many sadhus in India who had met Prabhupada before he started. And when you read it, it just shows how from day one he was commissioned, you know, to do this global work. And then when you read about some of the austerities and difficulties and things that he did before he had this, you know, thousands and thousands of people who were assisting him, and you see that Krishna used him in the most amazing way, and how he was determined to serve his guru at any cost. So as we catch up with the mood of success, and this is done only in spiritual circles, but say you want to be an athlete. And, you know, you don't just go out and play and just think you're going to be good. You look at those who've gone ahead of you. What did they do? If you can, you talk with them, you associate with them, you find out about them, and you take on some of their lifestyle. Because, you know, there are formulas, you know, to success. So we look at what are the qualities of a sadhu. We look at what are the tenets of bhav, because bhav is the door for prema. And based on that, now we look at how to integrate those into our own life, and we try to take notice of what sadhus, sages actually have, what saints have those qualities. And then we want to associate and connect more with them so that we can imbibe those qualities. And the last part is that we should realize that the heavy challenges and tests that those who have gone before us have experienced, ours may not be as intense, but we have ours waiting for us also. And so, therefore, it's good to look at the models of success. So when you have your, I'd like to say, your own battle, you know, of Kurukshetra, that you'll be able, you know, be able to move through it. When people are calling these models around the world, and they're asking, you know, we're talking different things. One of the things that is becoming a mantra for me, that everyone is going to have to deal with their particular test for purification, ultimate purification. And let's pray that when you have yours and when others have theirs, that as many as possible, you know, will be successful. Someone calls me and they want to have a pity party and they're crying on the phone. Now, I'm crying a lot myself, but most times I'm crying is due to the experiencing of the love, you know, that I'm getting from the devotee. Like today is the first time since I've been sick that I came down, I didn't cry. You know, and I started chanting, I just started crying. And I just, you know, it's like, okay, let me get the crying out of the way so I can, so I can speak. You know, so I can speak. The day when I sat down, I thought, I cried my cry last year, at least I don't have to cry now. If I get out of the way, I'm kind of ready. Let me share what I want to share. But that's because, you know, my heart is opening up more and more, and I'm experiencing that, you know, love from the devotees. So, I share with them, in most cases, sometimes I cry with them on the phone also, but usually I share with them, you know, first they're shocked because my voice is strong, and at times it's not so strong, but they're shocked, realizing how critically ill I am, and I seem to have this kind of strength. And then I kind of let them know, your turn is coming. you know, get ready for how Krishna is going to give you your particular challenge and test. If you're going on day to day, mysterious way of literally asking for acceleration and purity and greater service, sanctified service, then there will be obstacles and blocks and challenges to that. A lot of that will mean that things that we are comfortable with and things that we have hide or supports that we've had, some of those must be taken away in order for us to lean less on that which is distracting, superfluous, and artificial, to be able to lean more, you know, on Krishna. And I don't like that, you know. I mean, I'm the kind of person, I like to meticulously control also. I like to know what I'm going to do next week, next month, you know, so much planning. I'm going to do this seminar this month, that seminar. I go here, I go there, the TV program, this press conference, meet the devotees, this place, that place. And I would be organizing my life in such a way that this is going to be what I'm going to do this month, next month, and a constant scheme of living in the present, but mostly preparing for the future. And now I have to live, you know, more directly in the present. Well, I'm really preparing for the future, but, you know, more in the present. And so there's a part of me that says, hey, I don't like this. I don't, and I was laughing a couple of times when people called me, and I said, you know, the Vaidhita Maharshi, who so passionately is on his feet all the time, singing, dancing, traveling all around the world, now my international global travel is from the bed to the couch and chair. You know? I mean, literally. In day's time, I just make a little circuit. You know? So I'm a good bed sword, and then I go to the couch, you know, and then I go to the chair, and, you know, that's my around the world. So there's times when I'm thinking, damn, you know, what's going on here? After all these years of service to the Lord, you know, this is what I get, you know, confined to a room, you know, not knowing when I'm going to leave or if I'm going to stay. And then at the same time, I realize, yeah, this is the wages. This is the reward that's unfolding, you know, and this is the way it's coming. So you are preparing yourself to be more of an agent of service. You're focusing on trying to depend more on the Lord. You're desiring to be more compassionate and to be a greater global change agent. And so here it is now. So now you don't even have to go on the planes and spend the money for the tickets most of the time. That what you're saying goes out around the world, and people are calling you. Most times I don't even call. They call me. So I don't even have to charge up the phone bill here. So in so many ways in disguise, it's brought me a lot closer to so many devotees. We discuss things, and my disciples around the world, and I'm just amazed at the transition that's taking place, you know, many temples and with devotees. And so I'm eager to see where this all goes, you know, what's the closure, you know. As I said earlier, I kind of feel my time is over, but that Krishna's given me some extra time, borrowed time, and that time that's borrowed will probably be to the degree that I can still have some effectiveness. And so whether that's months or years, and when the effectiveness is no longer accelerating, then I think I'll be called out. You know. Okay? Give me 1 to 2 left questions. Yes? Tabataka is one of the most senior devotees in our movement. He's probably our senior most GBC, a governing body commission. We have an international commission that runs our society. In terms of being on that board, he's probably the most senior. How long he's been on that? Then Gopal Krishna Maharaj, and I think myself third. So he's very senior Vaishnava. So she's going to read a letter Prabhupada wrote to him. Thank you. how to approach that? When I first said I left my body, what I was implying is that the Bhakti Tirtha Swami that you already knew is really had changed, and that this experience has opened up some doors, so to speak, opened up some channels to consciousness. This experience has, have given me a time scheme, so to speak. In other words, I'm doing things in general. I'm always rushing and trying to do as many things as possible at the same time. Rarely am I doing one thing. Like I said, right now, we're doing like five things right now. But that's my nature. I'm usually doing many things at the same time. But now this experience has let me understand a little better that there is going to be a time soon when whatever I have done is done, and that's it. So there's a change in consciousness. When Brahma gave up his body, there's pastime in the Bhagavatam, how one of the Lord Brahmas, our Lord Brahma is a pure devotee, one Brahma's position oversees the material creations, so became attracted to his own daughter, and then became was influenced by some of his creation wanting to have sex with him. It was like a lust thing. So Lord Brahma's conscience was not fully in the right place. So he gave up the body. He shifted and changed his consciousness, because we have the physical body and we have the subtle body. And the subtle body is even more important in many ways than the physical body, because the subtle body is also carrying us lifetime after lifetime. When there's death to the physical, then the subtle body goes on to the next place, if we are taking physical bodies. We go back to Godhead, physical body goes, subtle body goes, and now the soul goes back. So first when I said that I've changed bodies, it means that there's been a shift in consciousness. You can't go through all of these excruciating near-death experiences, such a shift in lifestyle, and not have a major shift, you know, in consciousness, unless you're like really in denial. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that there's a serious number of my disciples, when they first heard me or saw me, they had, for lack of a better word, a mystical experience. You know, there's a couple who were part of this project. When they first saw me, they realized that this is a person that had been seen in their dreams. And then one day they physically see me. So it means that, in more than likely in those cases, it's someone who was with me in a previous life, and now we've come back. Now, to what degree they get it this time, that's an issue. All over the world, I have, and see, it's, all this is according to the quality of the disciple and the quality of the guru. Disciple is all different, and guru is all different. So again, we all have an individual relationship with Krishna. So there are different levels of purity and devotion amongst disciples, different levels of purity amongst guru. So now, that also is in connection with how much that entity who is guru is responsible for that particular disciple. When a disciple is highly dedicated, that guru is responsible for seeing that that particular soul gets back to the kingdom of God. And it may mean physically coming back in a form to be available. The disciple comes through. Like I have some disciples who left their body. You know, I have maybe almost 75, I think I counted one time, 65, 75 disciples, you know, who left their body. Most didn't go back to God here. Almost none. Excuse me, but I'm just telling you. But several have come back as children of some of my disciples, or they have come back in environments where my presence is available for them. So in this case, it goes on. And to the degree that there's a very intense seriousness, and to that degree, one locked in to helping that particular soul. Now the other thing is that guruship can often be like somebody's working, I just can't think of the word I said many times. Somebody's working for the diplomatic corps, for the foreign service, and you get stationed in different places. But then sometimes you get called back home. Huh? And so you're stationed, and you may go here to Italy, you may go to France, you may go to Spain, and then sometimes you get called back home. So from what I can see now, and that can change, it's all up to my spiritual master. And I don't want to sound arrogant, you know, or one doesn't reveal their bhajan, especially in public arenas. But from what I can see, by mercy, is that more than likely when I leave, I get called back this term. With ability to come and go, but not vividly seen. In other words, some of our devotees who've left behind already, Prabhupada's disciples, they have been called to join him. And they may enter in and out of this universe, but not in a physical body, but not, will not be seen. And they're still having influence on their disciples, on the institution, but not that they necessarily took birth in a physical body. And some have. Some have left and they've come back in another, in a physical body. Some are the Gurukula, some will be Gurukula kids or kids of some of the devotees in some cases. Older disciples that may come, they can be close to the environment and take the devotional life. So there's really a way to understand this is two part. One, the change of body, change of mind, culture, mindset, and that the eternal relationship between guru and disciple is really up to Krishna. That it's really about Krishna calling that soul in. And so if it fits nicely, Krishna is happy with it and it's going, Krishna can keep the same mentor responsible directly or arranging for that soul. It's not always that mentor has to physically come, but has responsibility to delegate and arrange, you know, for that soul. So how Krishna arranges, that's up to him. Whether he sends the same entity back, whether he sends an aspect of the entity back, whether he sends someone who's the help of the entity to help others, that's all up to the Lord. And that's the beauty. Realizing that it's an amazing science and how much Krishna personally is involved, you know, in everyone's rescue. Maybe I'll take two more questions and I'll stop. Because I think also some of you may need to get out of here before the snow gets too heavy, you know. Because we don't mind you staying. We can all crash on the floor. She's emphasizing is a near-death experience that relative had. We see that happening a lot is that, you know, people die every day. But some people have a second chance. And there's many reasons according to their karma why they may be called back into the body after having this near-death experience. And so that may be some, you know, suggestion or some implication that perhaps I would have already left, but all the prayers of devotees may very well be keeping me around, you know, somewhat longer. Mm-hmm. It's a great possibility that that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
have to speak according. Yeah, we have to speak according to the Scripture. We're happy that we have guidance from mentor, but we have to realize that the spiritual master is simply a disciple of his guru, his agent of service. Desire is so important, and what we individually desire, what we collectively desire, is going to produce some results. We have to be careful about, you know, what we desire. We want to, we'll have to take one more question and we'll stop. We want to come to a point where our desires are like the case of Uddhava and also Pradyumna, who wouldn't eat anything unless Krishna had eaten, wouldn't think or go anyplace unless they were sure that this is what Krishna wants. In the material world, we have the tendency that we want to be our own agent. But spiritually, we actually really want to be able to be used by the higher. We want to be happy that somehow we can be used and be of service in such a way. So our desire should be more and more, how can we be a selfless servant? So take that question. Association is important. That's where connecting with elder sadhus, with guru. Just like somebody who wants to be a doctor, okay? So it's not just a matter of reading books, although a book is important. But it's reading the books, and it's also taking an internship where you are around others who've also read the books and know the knowledge to see, you know, how it's applied. Because as you are dealing with the patient, it's not just a matter of just what was in the book, but you have to look at the metabolism, the mentality, the level of criticalness of the disease, etc. And then you do what was necessary. So it's similar. So there's certain basic things that we have been given, you know, as Vaishnavas, but then we are to act upon those, you know, through community. As we do that, the Lord being in everyone's heart, recognizing that one agent is trying to be serious to know him, will arrange the type and the particular association that will help that particular person in being able to grow and to serve better. And we'll end with that. It takes us back to Swarup Lakshana, depending on the Lord. We don't we normally know how much stuff that we're shackled by our karma, things from the past. We don't always know what we're going to have to run into in the future, but God knows, Super Soul knows, and the Lord is that close. He's in the heart, so He can, for Him to tick or to adjust this or that or to alter a situation, there's nothing. He's controlling everything. Om Savasya Prabhupada Mataktivam Bhavadite. So He's controlling all universes, material and spiritual things. So for Him to make some adjustment to make this thing successful, or to make this shift or that shift, or to arrange whatever is necessary for one, you know, it's not a problem. That's why faith or shraddha is important, because we have more faith, then we let Him do those things more expediently. But it's hard, you know, to have faith when we are living in a world that's so faithless, that's so challenging and so exploitive. So one is not to have blind faith, but to have faith in looking close at what is possible, and then to be ready to take the risk, because faith always involves risk. There cannot be any serious success without some risk. But the risk should be planned so that one is reposing their attention and dedication where there is greater opportunity for success. And then we take the risk. So this dependency, it really means take a risk, because it puts us out of the control of the situation. But we don't mind being out of control if we can be under a greater controller that has even greater opulences and power than what we have within ourselves. And so that is the platform of devotion and love. We are submitting ourselves to the ultimate source of love, protection, and control, and saying, you know, like Draupadi, you know, I'm yours. You know, Otara, Bahi Bahi Mahayogin, Deva Deva Jagapate, saying, oh, you are the supreme mystic. You know, only you can save me. Krishna is a supreme mystic. Godhead is a supreme mystic. So that means that all kinds of miracles, what we would call miracles, or phenomenal things, can happen if we just allow ourselves to be in a position to receive and to experience. So keep in mind these type of discussions. You know, we're just trying to apply philosophy in a practical way based on our present situation and some universal needs, because we're all just moments away from having to leave the body. And we all want to understand more the keys and the secrets of advancement. And this is a major one. Rupa Goswami has made that very emphatic. You know, dependency on the Lord. And dependency means that we have to see ourselves less as a controller. And then we put ourselves forth for the mercy of the ultimate controller. His confound the jar, his divine grace, AC, Bhaktivinoda Swami, the Prabhupada Ki, Vaishnava the Gorki.